This is a diverse audience, and I hope be sufficiently clear for everyone. If not, please ask me questions, interrupt me. So I'm going to talk about the paper we are writing with Henry Lin, who's a student at Princeton, and Ying Yao Chao, who's a postdoc at the Institute. But let me start with some preliminaries. We want to think of black holes as quantum systems, and there's a basic assumption that we all make in this field. I guess you could call it the central dogma. In biology, they have the central dogma, right? In this field, the central dogma is that the black hole, as seen from the outside, can be described as a quantum system with order s degrees of freedom or order s qubits. So you need a quantum mechanical system with a Hilbert space of at least e to the s dimension. And there are some caveats, like, of course, it's coupled to the black hole is coupled to the outside, so the system is also coupled to the rest of the spacetime. It's important that this is supposed to hold for a black hole as seen from the outside, and there is no claim made about the inside or other things. And part of the question is how to discover the inside. So this is a picture, so we can replace the black hole by some set of interacting, they have to be strongly interacting, quantum bits. And there are various reasons for this. One reason is the ADS-CFT, or the gauge gravity duality, which relates theory in anti-sitter to theory on the boundary. And then a black hole is a hot fluid of particles on the boundary. There are also more recent toy models that have very nice features, like the SYK model, that consists of N-interacting Majorana fermions. And this model has the virtue of being solvable, but nevertheless displaying many of the features of black holes. And in particular, it has many properties in common with nearly extremal charged black holes. So these are a special type of black holes that has a near horizon geometry, which is close to ADS2 times some other spaces. So ADS2 is the Lorentzian version of hyperbolic space. So hyperbolic space, two-dimensional hyperbolic space, is a space with negative curvature. This is the same thing, but with Lorentzian signature. And so this is an example of a relationship between a nearly scale-invariant theory and a nearly ADS2 spacetime. Now, if we have a black hole that is made from collapse, it has a spacetime geometry which roughly looks like this. This is the Penrose diagram. So it has some region far away, and then there's a star and collapses into a singularity, etc. And these type of black holes have one exterior and one interior. Now, in a lot of recent discussions, we've been studying black holes that have two exteriors. So there are two, it's really more like a wormhole of a pair of black holes. So this is a solution. It's the simplest solution the simplest spherically symmetric solution of general relativity, the solution that Schwarzschild found when properly analytically extended, as these people have shown, has this Penrose diagram. This each square here, the right square, represents a space that is asymptotically flat, far away, and here we have a horizon, and similarly here is asymptotically far, and here we have the future horizon, past horizon, etc. So they have the feature that they share a single interior. So these are like two black holes that share a single interior, and it looks a bit like a wormhole. In fact, this spatial section is called the Einstein-Rosen bridge, and it has a geometry in space that comes from infinity, goes through a narrow neck, and then expands again. And this is a solution with no exotic matter. In fact, it has no matter. It's a vacuum solution, and it has these features. And so if we said before that one black hole was equal to a quantum system, what do these two connected black holes correspond to? So that's a question we can ask. And the idea is that this type of geometries, which consist of two black holes that might be in the same space, this is a minor modification to the previous Penrose diagram, but they could be connected and share a single interior. So the idea is that this kind of solution corresponds to not one quantum system, but two quantum systems. And the quantum systems are the same ones that we had for a single black hole, but they are in a special state. They are in a particular entangled state. And the fact that this is a particular entangled state implies that the geometry is connected through the horizon. So the entangled state is supposed to be the thermophile double state, so a state where you take all the energy levels of one quantum system You have all the energy levels of the identical quantum system, and you combine them with this thermal looking factor. The near horizon geometry of these black holes has a symmetry, a Bose symmetry around the center. And this Bose symmetry is the same symmetry that corresponds to the time translation symmetry far away from the black hole. So the black holes look seen from the outside, they are a time translation invariant state. We have a time translation invariant isometry far away from the black hole. And that isometry is an isometry of the whole space-time, but it does not act as global time translations everywhere. At some points, it acts like a boost. Especially in the center, it acts as a boost. Here in this region, it acts as space translations, and so on. Okay. So that's a feature of this symmetry, and this is a feature of any black hole has this feature if it has finite temperature. So a rotating, non-extremal rotating black hole in four dimensions, or well, there could be many examples. They all have this geometry very close to the horizon. And this symmetry corresponds to an exact symmetry of the quantum system, which is the Hamiltonian of the system on the right minus the Hamiltonian of the system in the left. So it corresponds to, this symmetry corresponds to moving time forwards on the right and backwards on the left, and that leaves this state invariant because the two energies are equal. So as a side comment, I would mention that the fact that this is an exact symmetry is in particular saying that there is no simple bulk discretization in gravity, right? If you come from a condensed matter physics background, you might think that, okay, in gravity maybe there is some lattice at very short distances, and we get gravity at long distances with some emergent relativity or emergent speed of light. But in situations like this, if that's supposed to make sense in this geometry, the Bose symmetry should be exact. This particular Bose generator should be exact. And that seems incompatible with having a lattice structure. I mean, there are other reasons why you shouldn't have a lattice structure, but this is one reason. Now, there are other two approximate symmetries. These are not exact symmetries, but they are approximate symmetries of the near horizon region. And they arise because the near horizon region looks like flat space. And in flat space, besides having a Bose symmetry, we also have two translation symmetries. Here we're thinking about only two-dimensional part of the black hole geometry, just that's the radial direction and the time direction. And for the rest of the talk, we'll concentrate on essentially two-dimensional black holes, focusing only on this type of isometries. So the geometry here looks like Minkowski space. So in Minkowski space, we have time translation symmetries generated by, let's say, the energy, and then space translation symmetries generated by momentum. So they just shift the coordinates in this obvious way. These are not exact symmetries because if there are, let's say, some extra dimensions, like the directions of the sphere, those directions will have different behavior. So for example, if it is an actual black hole, the two-sphere volume increases in this direction and decreases in that direction, and that breaks the symmetries. But that's a small breaking, and for this talk, we'll consider that as a small breaking. So this talk will be about these two other approximate symmetries and how these symmetries are realized in the quantum theory. So these symmetries are interesting because they move a particle which is in the exterior region to particles which are in the interior, right? So understanding better these symmetries allows us to move particles, allows us to explore the interior of the black hole. So we will discuss this for near extremal black holes. And these are described by a nearly ADS2 gravity theory. And the same structure appears in the SYK model. And now what I'm going to do now is I'm going to review the structure I'm talking about in these two cases. This will be a review. And then we'll discuss the construction of symmetries later. So first, a review of nearly ADS2 gravity. So this is a kind of gravity theory which arises when you consider a near extremal black hole in four dimensions, for example. So you have four-dimensional space, flat space far away. You have a black hole that is charged and carries charge bigger than the mass. When the mass approaches the charge, then the Hawking temperature goes to zero, and the geometry develops a very long throat, very long region, where the size of the S2 is almost constant, and the rest of the other two dimensions, so the time and radial direction, form a nearly ADS2 space-time. This theory is described by So an Einstein-looking term, and this in two dimensions, this is a topological invariant, and it only contributes to the extremal entropy, so the entropy of the black hole at in some limit of zero temperature. Then it has a piece that has to do with the basically the area of this S2 that we were talking about has some limiting value when the throat is very long, which is whose area is this phi zero, and then some small deviations from that area that it would be this phi. So keeping this extra, keeping that extra degree of freedom gives us this new term in the action. This is just a boundary term for associated to this term in the action. And then we can have some matter in the bulk, in the bulk space, and this matter will propagate in essentially ADS2 space. And for writing the matter term, we'll neglect this small deviation for the area, so that the matter moves in purely ADS2 space with no coupling to this field that is sometimes called the dilaton. Now, when you integrate out this field, this acts as a delta function that fixes the metric to be constant negative curvature. So it fixes the metrics to be ADS2. And then the matter, that implies the matter, moves in a rigid ADS2 spacetime. So the dynamics is very simple. And there is here a boundary term that you should add to make the action well-defined, because there are second derivatives here. And once you add this boundary term, there is one degree of freedom that remains out of the metric and scalar field. And we can think of this as a kind of boundary graviton, or as a degree of freedom that essentially keeps track of the mass of the black hole and some other properties of the black hole. So essentially the mass. So we have a very simple gravitational dynamics of this nearly ADS2 space. So we basically start with a rigid ADS2 space, or some space that does not back react to the motion of anything that is moving on it. We have matter that moves freely within this ADS2 space in some limit. And then we have some boundaries far away. So what the boundaries mean is that we have this ADS2 space, and then at some point we'll glue this ADS2 space to, let's say, flat space, for example, right? And then that gluing is done in such a way that the proper time along these boundaries corresponds to the physical time of the flat space theory. And that corresponds also to the physical time of the dual quantum mechanical theory that we were discussing in the very beginning. So we basically have three systems that each move independently, and each has an SL2 invariant in the sense that they move. So I didn't explain one thing. So the simplest case arises when these boundaries are very, very far away. So you can take some limit where the size of the length of these throats is very, very long. And here we are drawing the picture for the two-sided black holes. So this one boundary is the boundary of one black hole, and the other boundary is the boundary of the other black hole. And so in that limit, that the boundaries are very far, then matter feels as if it's in a full ADS2 space. And so it's fully invariant under SL2, the isometry of ADS2. And also each boundary dynamics is invariant under SL2. So the Hilbert space really is a tensor product of three pieces. One is the Hilbert space for one boundary. The other one is the Hilbert space for the other, and the Hilbert space of matter. And a common isometry for all three is unphysical, should be viewed as unphysical, because that's all that matters is really the relative positions of the matter and the boundary, and so we are quotienting by an SL2 gauge symmetry. So this is a common motion of the three, and it's not physical, it's just a redundancy of the description. So we'll keep on this redundancy, but these are not the symmetries we're after. So each of these is described by an SL2 invariant action, and the matter, as I said, moves in a rigid ADS2 space. And then to describe the motion of the boundary, or even the position of the boundary, we can use various types of variables, and one that will be useful for what we are doing is the following. So you can first consider, let's consider ADS2 space and write it as a point in R2,1. So you have a space with two time-like directions and one space-like direction. But then you put a constraint that is Lorentz invariant under the SL2 group. And this surface is, once you restrict that, you go from a three-dimensional space to a two-dimensional space. And this two-dimensional space is ADS2. Now, we're interested in points that are very close to the boundary, so we can somehow take a y which is very close, very large, and then rescale the value of y to get a finite value of x. So x is y, a very large y divided by a very large number, so we get some finite thing. And instead of this equation, then, because we divide it by something, this x obeys an equation which is zero. So by taking these null vectors, we can define a point that lives near the boundary. And then we can set the scaling by saying that the time, as you move, as they move in time, the square of the time derivative is one. This essentially fixes their size. Anyway, so these are points. So the motion of the boundary is expressed in terms of the boundary time, which is also equal to the proper length along the boundary, proper time along the boundary. So each of these systems is SL2 invariant, and we said that we impose an overall SL2 singlet constraint, and that's saying that the charges, these are SL2 charges of each of the systems, should add up to zero. Right? So like for the matter, for example, that's just, these are just the ordinary SL2 charges of matter, like the total energy, the total momentum of matter inside ADS2, and so on. Okay, now we are interested in the symmetries that move matter inside this space, and the most naive one would be to say that there are these Q matters, because that's the, those are the generators that move matter inside of the space. But they are not weight gauge invariant, so they have this gauge index, so we need to really construct something that is gauge invariant. And another way of saying this is that we should properly couple them to gravity and write something that is invariant under the gravitational constraints. So we can think of this SL2 symmetry as something that remains from the gravitational constraints of the full dynamics of the theory. So usually in the canonical description of gravity, there are some constraints. And in this case, we solve some of them, and we retain only three global constraints, which are these ones. OK, so that's the story of nearly ADS2 gravity. And now I'll give a short review of SYK, and I'll try to explain why in SYK we get exactly the same structure. So I guess I'm assuming that you have some familiarity with SYK. So SYK is a model of N-Majorana fermions with all-to-all interactions. And the theory has a simple, relatively solvable large N limit, where the action of all these N fermions reduces to the action of just one field, which is essentially a function of two variables. And once you impose the equations of motion or you're in the functional integral, this becomes the fermion two-point function, either after you impose the equations of motion or after you do the functional integral. And at low energies, this theory develops an approximate conformal symmetry, and where this function of two times has a scaling solution. And in the infrared, there is a family of solutions that can be obtained by applying a time reparametrization symmetry to the above one. So this is only an approximate symmetry and is explicitly broken. And the final low energy action has the following form. So it consists of essentially three pieces. So this is in the Lorentzian signature space, where we have these two boundaries, or we have two copies of the SYK model. Then we have one of these actions, Schwarzian actions, for one of the sides, another action for the other. And you can get this action by thinking about the pattern of symmetry breaking. And then finally, you have an action for the fluctuations of G, which are not reparametrization. So there are some fluctuations of G which are reparametrizations of the original scaling solution, and some which are orthogonal to them. And so the action for the orthogonal ones is approximately conformal invariant and finite, and that's what this term is representing here. And this is analogous to the action of matter for the gravity theory, and it's independent of these functions f. These functions f are analogous to the positions of the boundary that we were discussing before, and it's a way actually of parametrizing. We can parametrize the position of the boundary particle by giving this map between the proper time and some particular coordinate time in ADS, which we can call f. So So the point you should get, so if you're not, well, if you're not following the details, the point you should get is that we have two systems which have the same structure in their Hilbert space. There are something we are calling boundary variables or some degrees of freedom that have a especially simple action. And then some bulk degrees of freedom which move in the bulk, or some other degrees of freedom which are exactly SL2 invariant. Okay? And that exact SL2 symmetry is really a gauge symmetry. And we impose, so each of these terms has an SL2 symmetry, and we impose an SL2 gauge singlet constraint. That's the story. Now, to be a little precise, we get exactly this structure only in some limit, in the limit that n goes to infinity and beta j goes to infinity, keeping n over beta j fixed. So n over beta j is related to the coefficient appearing here in front of the action, so those terms remain fixed. And in this limit of the model, we get exactly this structure, which is the same structure we had before. Okay. If we don't take this limit, then there are further corrections that go like 1 over beta j or 1 over n to this structure. Okay. So now we'll discuss how we can construct this gauge invariant operators. So we said that we basically want something that looks like the matter generators, and one way to make them gauge invariant is to consider these boundary variables, which are related to the gravitational degrees of freedom of the system. We can define an operator by taking these vectors that have a gauge index A. This index goes from 1 to 3. We take the cross product of these two vectors, and then we take the product with the Q matter, so that's something that does not have any SL2 gauge indices, and so that defines some operator. Now, what does this operator correspond to in this gravity theory is the following. So, at some point in time, for the left and right times, the boundary will be at some location in ADS. So these are this x left and x right, parameterize the position of the boundary particle, okay? The positions of the physical boundaries. And then we consider a geodesic that goes between one and the other. And then there are the symmetries that correspond to translations along this geodesic. That will be one particular element of SL2R, of the SL2R symmetry. And that's the one that is defined here. In general, you define a generator which takes the three generators and you dot it with a vector, we can think of this vector here as a point on ADS2 by this embedding formulas we were discussing here before. Here we can think of that as a particular y, which is a point in ADS2, and that point is a point that is fixed by these symmetries. So the symmetries act like a boost around this point. And well, that indeed corresponds to these two points, which are obtained by taking light rays from the endpoints and where they cross. This type of region in space-time is sometimes called a Wheeler-DeWitt patch. So this is a region of all points that are space-like separated from the boundary. If you take any slice on this region, you can go to any other slice by using the constraints of general relativity, or you can evolve using the bulk equations without needing any information about what the boundaries are doing. Okay? So once you have one slice, you can go to the next slice without knowing that. If you want to go to some other slice, let's say this slice around here, then you would need to know what the boundary conditions are. But if you only want to move within this little square, or maybe I should say rectangle, then you can do it within one little patch. And this operator just acts within this patch, within the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. So it moves points from the left to the right, but does not move you away from the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. And because it's gauge invariant, it's a good physical symmetry of the gravity theory. So in this full gravity theory, it's a good symmetry. Now, in the same way, we can define two others that by dotting them to the vectors x left and x right, which were the boundary position, and by taking linear combinations, we can form the so-called energy generator, well, the boost and energy generator, so we can take a linear combination of these two in such a way that so we take this, this line, and we look at the midpoint of the line, and then the boost around the midpoint is a generator that is defined in a, again, in a gauge invariant way. And here, then we can have the time translation symmetry that is orthogonal to this line. So this is orthogonal in Lorentzian signature, so these lines are actually orthogonal in Lorentzian signature. And that defines what we are calling the energy generator. I'm calling them boost, energy, and momentum, but they are really obeying an SL2R symmetry algebra. And they are really having an expression which involves, well, the matter generators and then three vectors. The index A goes from 1 to 3. That was what we called boost, energy, and momentum. I'm calling them like that because this is how they act around the point in the center. So in the point, for the point of view of the point in the center, this looks like a boost. This looks like some time translation. And the previous one looks like some space translation. So out of the positions of the two boundary particles, we construct the three vectors. And then in this way, we construct the gauge invariant operators. And they act on the physical Hilbert space of the theory. And so this in particular implies that the Hilbert space is infinite dimensional. Because the representations of SL2 are infinite dimensional, the unitary representations. Now, this is not in contradiction with the finiteness of the dimension of the Hilbert space of the SYK model, for example, because in order to get to exactly this structure, we needed to take this particular limit when n goes to infinity. Okay. So, I'm here using bulk language to describe these symmetries, but as I explained before, they are also present in the SYK model in this particular Larsen limit. And we should not confuse these three SL2 symmetries with the SL2 gauge symmetry. So the SL2 gauge symmetries are not physical. They're just a redundancy of the description. These ones are act on the physical Hilbert space. Now, so I said these are good symmetries of the quantum gravity theory. But we are not, and they contain some quantum gravity corrections, like the fact that the coupling of the Schwarzian theory is finite. So if you're doing the path integral over the Schwarzian, and that's some kind of integrating over some quantum corrections, those are included. But we are not including the effects of other topologies. So effectively, we are taking this extremal entropy to be infinite to suppress the effects of other topologies. And these charges are well defined in this limit. That's the claim. Now, of course, one would be interested in including also these things, but then in those cases, we don't expect. So if S0 was finite, we don't expect the existence of exact SL2 generators, because if S0 is finite, then the Hilbert space should be finite. And so the x dependence of these vectors could be viewed as a kind of gravitational dressing or you have to include the gravitational degrees of freedom in the definition of your physical generators. So these charges do not commute with the Hamiltonian, because the boundary positions depend on time. And for that reason, these generators actually do depend on time. But they only depend on time through this motion of the boundary particles. But that motion it's a relatively simple motion. I mean, that motion is the motion of just a particle, is similar to a particle, or let's say a relativistic particle close to its non-relativistic limit, moving in ADS2. So it's a solvable problem. And so to the extent that we can solve for the boundary positions, we can solve for that dynamics, then we can invert that dynamics and then write all these charges in terms of the positions at time equal to zero. And then if we do that, then we construct exactly conserved charges, conserved in the sense that they commute with the Hamiltonians. The Hamiltonians are the Hamiltonians on the boundary. Those would be the Hamiltonians of the dual boundary theory. Now, so far, we've given these expressions that involve the behavior of matter in the bulk, and it is possible to rewrite all these expressions in terms of boundary quantities. So what we are planning to do now is the following. So we had these expressions written in terms of the bulk matter charges and so on, and then we plan to express them in terms of boundary quantities, and then we'll express them in terms of things that even make sense at finite end, but we'll have to make an approximation. So first we use the gauge constraint to write the matter charges in terms of the charges of the left and right particles. And once we have that, these boundary charges can be expressed in terms of these boundary positions, or if you wish, the function f that was appearing in the Schwarzian action. And when you do that, then you end up finding an expression. So I'm not giving you the details, I'm just giving you the final answer, that the momentum is equal to this derivative of the log of this inner product of the axis. And this log has the physical meaning of the distance between the two boundaries. So some kind of regularized distance between the two boundaries. I said the two boundaries were infinitely far away, but there is some infinity which is constant and independent of the positions of any dynamical degree of freedom. And then the finite piece is L, which is a dynamical variable. That's this length of this wormhole throat, essentially. And so we get an interesting expression which says that the momentum, this is the momentum of the matter, you could view it as the momentum of the matter or as really one of these combined SL2 charges of the full system, is equal to the time derivative of the position, so to the momentum of the boundary particles. And so this involves the distance between the two boundary particles. And the same inner product appears, or the same distance appears when you think about correlators. So if you have a correlator between operators on the boundary, let's say the operators could be like the operators in the SYK model, or it could be correlators of fields in the bulk gravity theory, but evaluated near the boundaries. The same type of expression appears. This is just the correlation function. This is one way in which we can write the correlation function in these coordinates. And so we get also this distance. I mean, this formula is not saying something complicated. It's just saying that in the bulk, the two-point function across the two boundaries is e to the minus, let's say, the mass of the field times the length that it has to travel, right? That's why it involves this distance. And so if we know these correlators, then we can extract the distance. We can think of the distance as an operator, which is the log of this product of fermions. Now, the log of the product of fermions is, in principle, not well-defined, because the product of fermions can be zero or negative and so on. But it's well-defined in the limit scaling limit that we defined before. So if we have, for example, in the SYK model, if we have n going to infinity, and, well, this limit that we defined before, in this limit, this correlation functions of fermions is always positive. Okay, so any finite excitation will flip some of the fermions, but not all n fermions. It will flip only a subset of order one of the fermions. So you cannot make it negative. So this distance is a quantity that is well defined only around this wormhole phase, so this particular limit and relatively low energies. And in this sense, it's similar, so to use a condensed matter analogy, similar to the phase of a superconductor, right? So the phase of a superconductor is a measurable quantity. Well, not for electrodynamics, but here I'm using superconductor as a system that breaks a global U1 symmetry. Okay. So this phase is a dynamical variable, but is not well defined in the full macroscopic theory in terms of the fermions. And this distance was previously thought in terms of complexity. So it was believed that we have to go outside the standard framework to define this distance. So here I'm trying to say that there are some special limits where you can really think of this distance in a more conventional way. Now we'll work a little more to get more explicit formula for these generators, but they will be approximate. So the catch will be that they will be approximate. But they will have the advantage of being well-defined in the finite-end theory. So in the finite-end theory, we'll write down some we'll write down an approximate expression for these generators that you could explore in a finite n situation. So we will do this not in general, but in the so-called semi-classical limit, where the difference between the entropy and the extremal entropy is relatively large. So that's the limit in which n over beta j is much bigger than 1. And that physically corresponds to the limit in which the Schwarzian theory, or this boundary degree of freedom, is behaving classical. So it's a classical limit of the gravity theory. So in this limit, the boundaries follow, let's say, the classical trajectories plus some small quantum fluctuations and small fluctuations. And so we can expand the positions of the, we can think of the positions in terms of a map between the physical time u and, let's say, the Rindler time or Schwarzschild time t in this way, where the first term is just the classical solution that involves the temperature. And then we have small fluctuations. So these epsilons are going to be much less than 1. And then we can go back to this expression, for example, of the momentum that was calculating the distance. And we put in this classical trajectories plus small fluctuations. And then we find that if we just put the classical trajectories of the empty wormhole, we get that all three charges are 0. But when we consider small fluctuations, we get expressions that involve derivatives of the small fluctuations. So these expressions are all true for to leading order in the fluctuations. Now, at the same time that we do this, we could also take the correlators of general correlators, such as this one. So this is expression is the expression we get by when we consider a correlation function in the theory, and then we couple it to the boundary mode. So we look at the effect of these time reparametrizations on the correlators, and so we get an expression of this form involving the map again between the physics, the bulk time and the proper time. This is sometimes called an infrared time. So when we put it in here and we expand, again we expand to linear order in epsilon, and then we'll find similar combinations of derivatives of epsilon, and so we can express all these charges in terms of correlators. So as an example, the expression for global energy that we discussed before, so this expression could also be obtained, we obtain an expression similar to the following. So imagine we had two identical but coupled SYK models, let's say one should be right and the other should be left systems, and we couple them in this simple way, just with the two Fermion interaction. So the ground state, the nice feature about this is that the ground state of this system is close to the thermofield double state at some temperature that is given by some combination of mu and j, the coupling of the SYK model. And then the expression for the energy that we discussed before is simply, essentially, this coupled Hamiltonian minus its expectation value, right? I said it should vanish for the thermofield double, so when we take this difference, that will vanish. So this 0 means that this is the expectation value for the thermofield double. For the empty thermofield double, this is the operator in a more generic state, which is a small perturbation of the thermofield double. And then there is some redshift factor that relates the normalization of the boundary time relative to the interior, or in other words, it's related to also the length of the wormhole, or in the SYK language, the amount of RG flow between the UV and the gap. The gap of the system. This is set in the gap of the system to be of order 1. So we find that this original expression that was always well defined is equal in the semi-classical limit to this combination of epsilons, and that's equal also to this operator that is well defined at finite n. This one was well defined only for n equal to infinity in some limit. This is well defined even at finite n, and in the semi-classical limit, they both agree. Now, this generator, we are thinking of this as a symmetry generator, generating the time translation symmetry of global ADS spacetime. This type of left and right coupling is the same type of coupling that appeared in the traversable wormhole construction of Gao, Jefferies, and Wall. And and it, in some sense, we are a bit like inverting the logic here. So they found that this type of couplings led to the motion of matter in the interior. And so we're now saying, well, we can think of this as an actual symmetry generator that generates a symmetry of the bulk theory, of the full theory. And this looks a bit funny to have a symmetry generator that contains these terms. But I, as a side comment, I should mention that this is also the type of structure that we have in an ordinary field theory when we think of the field theory in Rindler coordinates. So we have, if we have, for example, a two-dimensional field theory on a cylinder, so this is direction of space, then we have the direction of time, and we divide the cylinder into two halves, the left half, the right half, and the left half. Then we can have a boost symmetry here that corresponds to, let's say, the modular Hamiltonian of this region. And if we want to construct now the global energy generator, so the global time translation, it will be given just simply by the integral of T00 over the whole slice. And the integral over T00 of the slice is a sum of three terms. So one is some operator, which is the integral of T00 on the left side. Then there's the integral of T00 on the right side. But if we only include those pieces, which is what we naively would include, you are missing a very important piece, which is the piece that couples the left and right side. And this comes from, let's say, T00 exactly in the middle, which will involve a difference between, let's say, the field on the right and the field on the left, for example. And this is what couples the two sides together and allows you to have the global a symmetry that translates the whole system forwards in time. And so this type of coupling, rather than being weird, is exactly the same coupling you get, the same type of coupling you get in this setup. And so it's similar to what we had in this this SYK model, though the interpretation in the bulk is similar, but in the boundary is different. So that's the end of the side comment. So another point I wanted to make is that by thinking especially about these approximate symmetries, so in this semi-classical limit, the symmetries become the same as the SL2 symmetries of the boundary time. So they transform the boundary time coordinate in the standard SL2 way. And and you can use this discussion to define a kind of operator to state map for this nearly CFT1. So you have two copies of the so you can, the operator to state map is some map that is defined in conformal field theories that maps essentially operators defined in the Euclidean theory to states in the Lorentzian theory. And so here you have operators that act in, so you evolve in Euclidean time, you have operators that act during the Euclidean time evolution, and they create some state that on the boundary is defined at these two points on the boundary, in the bulk is defined as some particle in the bulk. The vacuum of the theory is mapped to the thermofield double state, and then insertions of operators map to, again, a state in two copies of the system. So the novelty is that the operator state map just maps operators of the original theory to states in two copies of the theory. And then by inserting these various generators, so the generators will contain terms that act purely on the left and purely on the right, and some terms that are products of left and right. And we can calculate all these matrix elements, and they agree with what you expect for an SL2 algebra. And the action of these generators and the generators themselves are, once you write them in terms of these left-right products, they are related to out-of-time order correlators. So you have, let's say, an operator, so the bulk matter is inserted by putting some fields here, and then we are measuring the bulk matter by considering this other correlator. Because we consider the other correlator because we need to measure the distance between these two points. And these type of correlators are the so-called out-of-time order correlators. Now, in previous papers, several of us have related the out-of-time order correlators to some simple bulk displacements, and here we are reverting the logic. Now, these operators we discussed also have some relationship to a quantity called size. So there were some papers by all these authors that have noticed the similarity between a notion called size and the motion in the radial direction of the bulk. These papers computed this in various setups, and they found experimentally, let's say by experimentally I mean doing the calculation, they found that they have properties very similar to the properties you expect for SL2 generators in ADS. And so the size is basically how many fermions an operator requires. So we can define in this way the size of an operator, but also the size of a state. So you can start from the infinite temperature thermofield double state, which is a very simple state consisting of essentially Bell pairs. And then if you have some other state, you can this is defined to have zero size. And then if you have some other state, you can obtain it by acting with fermion operators on this particular simple thermofield double, infinite temperature thermofield double state. And in that way, you generate the state you want. And now if you want to find out, well, how many operators did I need to apply, then you would find that you can calculate that by evaluating the expectation value of the left-right correlator. So the left-right correlator evaluates the size of the operator you need to act onto the thermofield level to get the state you want. And so notice that we said that the global energy is related to this particular operator with a precise relation here. So it regates the relationship between this size and the energy in the bulk. And not only that, but also because we're obeying an SL2 algebra, the momentum is related to the commutator of the boost with the energy. And this involves this difference of Hamiltonians. And because Hamiltonians commute with each other, this only acts on this size. And so the momentum is the same as the derivative of the size, how the size is changing as a function of time. Now, as I said, these generators are related to the out-of-time order correlators, whose growth as a function of time is related to chaos. And in fact, if you think about, for example, the energy generator, which we said was equal to this, and now we don't evaluate it at t equal to zero, but we evaluate it at some later time, then we find that, well, these terms will be conserved because the energy is conserved, but these other terms will grow with time. And this growth with time is the growth of out-of-time order correlators. So they grow when there is some excitation that was inserted in the middle or inserted by some other operator that was acting in the very early times. And so then by looking at very late times, this term will grow. And so, for example, here, so we look at this at very late times. So, and this term will grow exponentially, but then we can subtract the exponential decay, the exponential growth, and get something constant. And this constant thing that we get is equal to some combination of the energy and the momentum. So it's essentially P minus. So the momentum across minus direction. So in this case, the momentum across this. This is the minus direction, and it's the momentum conjugate to that translations there. And then here we get something similar, but moving the operators in the other direction. So we can think also of these charges as the coefficients of the exponential growth of out-of-time order correlators. So here we're simply inverting the ordinary logic that gives this growth, but thinking about this as generators of a symmetry. Now I have some comments now about in what sense these things are exploring the interior. So imagine that we have some interactions behind the horizon. So imagine that we have the standard thermofield double and we send two particles that go and interact behind the horizon. Now here we have, this is the full time evolution of the system. But if we look at the state, for example, at t equal to zero, so at t equal to zero we said we can only focus on the Wheeler DeWitt patch, so some piece of the overall geometry. And in this piece, it contains, certainly they contain the interactions, and we expect that the quantum state at t equal to zero should be describing all this region. Now, if we evolve that state with the decoupled Hamiltonian, then we get this full region of the spacetime geometry. And in this full region, this interaction point is behind the horizon from the point of view of the right observer, right? So, or also the left observer. So if you restrict your attention to either purely the right or purely the left, then you should get no information about the interaction between left and right. And it's this, the bulk picture is consistent with this and is consistent with the interpretation in the boundary theory. But if you decide to evolve with a different Hamiltonian, so for example, you put some interactions between left and right, then now you can see this interaction point. Okay? And this is fine, it doesn't contradict anything, because now there is an interaction between the two sides. So if you send a perturbation from one and a perturbation from the other, it's reasonable that they could have interacted. This interaction that before was behind the horizon by evolving with a different Hamiltonian now looks a little more real, because you can actually see the effects that this interaction has in a simple way. So we can say that by acting with two-sided operators, we can see the interior, but at the price of changing the evolution here in the boundary. Or you can equivalently say that when we evolve in this different way, we create the interior. So it's not clear how we should interpret it. Now, one question you can ask is whether we can use all these symmetries we've been talking about to explore the region near the inner horizon, or even the question of whether matter propagates beyond the inner horizon. The point of this slide is to point out the similarities that exist between these two-dimensional black holes and Coleman de Luce decays to ADS. If we look at this diagram, so this is an ADS diagram with the boundary particle in Euclidean space. So this looks very much like the bound solution that is giving you a decay from a false vacuum to a true vacuum in ADS space. And the Lorentzian evolution of that gives you a bubble. So in this case, the bubble is the whole space, so we really only have the interior of the bubble in our problem. And this bubble expands, and then it hits the boundary of ADS spacetime here. And you might have, classically, you might think this space continues, and that's what the classical solution seems to say. What Coleman de Luce pointed out was that if you had any scalar field, for example, or any field, that any irrelevant deformation that is present here at the boundary theory will have a finite value here at the horizon, and then that sets up some initial conditions for the evolution on this region of the geometry, which looks like, so this geometry would be, looks like an FRW universe with, there is one dimension of space, and then, which is a symmetry. And then here it's expanding from a big crunch that is actually not singular. But then when it reaches the other point here, if we didn't have any matter, it would be non-singular. But because of this irrelevant perturbation that was present, it will lead to some singularity, at least for the propagation of matter. So from this point of view, we don't expect to, we expect to have some problem here in the inner horizon. Another issue is that we argued before that the matter in the bulk obeys standard boundary conditions at infinity, but the boundary conditions for the matter in the bulk come from where this brain is. And at some point after this brain reaches the boundary of ADS, we don't know really what the boundary conditions for matter is. So we don't have any right to continue evolving the matter beyond beyond these points. Okay, so I'd like to finish now with some more conceptual problems. And maybe, these problems maybe will resonate a little bit with, these comments might resonate a little bit with the condensed matter people. So, sorry, my talk was a bit technical, but it was initially supposed to be a talk for the string seminars. This comment, if you have fallen asleep and you didn't follow what I was talking about, this is the moment to wake up, okay? And the moment you can disagree with it. Okay, so I'd like to first start with an analogy between this problem of the two coupled SYK models and superconductors. Now, when I talk with condensed matter people with superconductors, I realize that when mentioned this, the condensed matter person has many more assumptions of what a superconductor is than I have. So for me, a superconductor will be simply a system with a spontaneously broken U1 symmetry. Okay? That's my definition. So imagine we take the charge SYK model, so this model that it's a small modification of SYK that has considered. So here we have fermions, but they are fermions charged under U1 symmetry. And so we take now two copies of this kind of model, not the standard SYK, but the charged one. And then we put an interaction that looks a bit reminiscent to the BCS interaction. So it's an interaction bilinear in the fermions that couples the left and right, but in a way that it preserves the two U1 symmetries of the independently of the left and right models. If you want it to make it relevant, then make this Q bigger than 4SYK. It's a bit simpler. If you don't know what that is, don't worry about it. Not necessary. Now, the idea is that the wormhole solutions that we've been talking about, or even the solutions of the low energy limit of SYK model, it's a solution that spontaneously breaks the difference between these two U1s. Okay? But it preserves the sum of the two U1s. And so there is a Goldstone mode, and in this charge model is a variable that you explicitly include in the low energy description. It's part of the mode similar to the Schwarzian. And in the gravity, it has an interpretation as the integral of the Wilson line of the gauge field across the two boundaries. Okay? So that's how I think we should think about this, especially in the classical limit. This is a state that breaks spontaneously the U1. That is, we don't have just one state, we have a family of states. They're all, as we go through this family, they're all essentially orthogonal to each other, and they represent this spontaneous breaking of the symmetry. In the classical limit, so the Laurentian limit, all these states are orthogonal to each other. Now, if instead we had an interaction which preserved only the overall U1 but broke also the difference between the U1s, then the symmetry in addition would be explicitly broken. Now, maybe you can say, well, I shouldn't think of a symmetry. I mean, this is now explicitly broken, but the idea is that when we consider these wormholes and the low energy limit of the theory, there is a sense in which the symmetry is both first spontaneously broken and then explicitly broken by this other interaction. Okay? So explicit breaking is much smaller than the spontaneous breaking. So in that sense, the state displays both the breaking of these two symmetries. And in this situation, this is not quite a Goldstone boson, so this phi variable, so before it could have any value, but now if we look at the ground state of this model, it will have a preferred value for phi. Okay, good, so that's some analogy. But now I claim that these wormholes that we've been talking about and also the ground states of these coupled SYK models should be viewed as time superfluids. Okay, what's a time superfluid? So I'm trying to define what I mean by a time superfluid. So people talk, for example, about time crystals. Okay, the time crystal is something you're familiar with this. So I like to make you familiar with time. I think we should think of these states as time superfluids. Let me try to explain what I mean. So we start with two time translation symmetries, the two separate H left and H right time translation symmetries. And when we look at the wormhole or the thermofield double of SYK model, we are really spontaneously breaking the sum of the two times, the sum of the two H's, but we preserve exactly the difference of the two H's. So the difference of the two H's is exactly preserved, we don't care about that, but we are breaking spontaneously the sum of the two. And that's what I mean by a time superfluid. Okay? So the symmetry of time translation has been explicitly broken. And the idea is that the Goldstone mode is a relative time shift between the two sides. And that's one of the physical modes of this wormhole. So when you have this wormhole, you have the possibility when you patch it to, let's say, flat space, of shifting, doing that with a shifted notion of time. Or equivalently, when you have the thermofield double, you have the opportunity to evolve one of the sides of the thermofield double by some amount delta U. And so the idea is that this delta U is the Goldstone boson in this setup. It's analogous to the Goldstone boson. So here we were drawing these space-time diagrams, and the two dots represent the boundary positions at some moment in time on the boundary. But what we call time equal to zero, so in one state, time equal to zero would be correspond to these two points. In the other, where we did the time shift, it would correspond to perhaps these two points. Okay, and we should think of these two as two different states in the same theory, that whose gravity interpretation is, of course, different. And well, it's different, but in this very simple way, and correspond to exciting this Goldstone boson. Now, I said it is analogous to the situation that I described before for the fermions, for the charged fermions. It's analogous to a situation where, in addition, we are breaking the symmetry explicitly. So imagine that you have a system with a U1 symmetry breaking, and you add a term in the Hamiltonian, which is just the charge that you have explicitly broken, right? So it would be like the U1 charge, right? You add a term to the Hamiltonian, which is Q. This term would generate a shift, a constant linear shift of the Goldstone boson that would be linear in time. And that's how we interpret this equation, that we have the constant shift of the, this, which I interpreted as a Goldstone mode, is just linear in the boundary times. And that's because the Hamiltonian is just linear in the charges that you are spontaneously breaking, which is the Hamiltonian itself. So this is valid for any of these thermofield doubles and so on, especially in the classical limit. And I think something more is going on in these setups, which is that in addition we're also breaking a space symmetry, which is related to the dilatation, relative dilatation between the two systems. And so we have a system that has more symmetries, which includes these approximate conformal symmetries on the two sides. And then we think that the thermofield double state is breaking this to a common SL2 symmetry, and that there are some Goldstone modes that correspond to the mass and time shift that we discussed before. Okay, so in conclusions, we explore some of the symmetries of the near horizon of the near extremum black hole, or SYK models. We constructed some exact SL2 generators, and we discussed some approximate expressions in the semi-classical limit, and we also explained how this notion of size is connected to energy and momentum. And then we discussed some slogans or some words that should go with this, that we get order from chaos, or we get these time superfluids, or maybe space and time superfluids. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah.
Hey, thank you. I have a question for you regarding these eternal black hole pictures, which I guess is dual to the thermofield double. So you have a singularity, a vital singularity in the past,
yeah.
Right? And if I have singularities in my past, then weird things can come out of singularities. And nevertheless, you assume that you just have vacuum. Is that a problem?
No, that's not the problem. So you should think of this, of the thermofield, yeah. You should think of this in the same way that Hartle and Hawking were thinking about this, right? So Hartle and Hawking were saying, you create the state at t equal to zero from the Euclidean evolution, and then you evolve the state either to the future or to the past, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's how we are thinking about this. So this is the same thing, and it's also the same way that you think about, for example, global de Sitter space. We are not making some assumption about the singularity and then evolving forwards. We are making an assumption about what happens at t equal to zero, and then evolving forwards and backwards in time. So from the point of view of the this evolution from the past to the future is a very fine-tuned evolution, right?
Right. Okay, thanks.
So when you discuss these two coupled charged SYK models, are you saying there's some interaction that prefers this excitonic instability, which is what I'd call it, some kind of particle-hole pairing? between the two, or just the thermofield double is one such state?
Yeah, yeah. So the thermofield. So if we yeah. So let me go back. The statement is that if we take the first Hamiltonian that we discussed,
this one,
then there is not one thermofield double, but there is a whole family, right? There is the thermofield double, and then we can do we can act with the U1 symmetry on the left, right, and get a whole family of states, all of which have the same energy with respect to this Hamiltonian. So we don't have just one ground state, but classically we have all of them have the same energy. Then when you quantize this mode, there will be one that will have less energy.
There's a compressibility, so they don't have the same energy. The HL and HR prefer some charge, which is zero, in fact, right?
Yeah, this could be zero charge. I'm not making any claim. Let's say we have zero charge, yes. Yes, let's say we have zero charge. But the point is that even that you have zero charge, you have this symmetry spontaneously broken in the classical limit. Right? So you don't have one ground state, but you have a family of ground states of this system. And they are separated by a gap from the next state.
Oh, okay. Well, all right.
Let me be... it's basically the same as a superconductor in finite volume, right? Because when n is finite,
I agree.
Is that the point that is making a confusion? Or?
No, I mean, I agree if there was some interaction that actually broke the symmetry. Like, it would be like, we'd call it an exotonic superfluid if you're breaking U1. The difference of the charges.
Yes.
But that requires some interaction, and it's a particular type of ground state.
No. Here
if
in
I
the
just take a random system like this, it won't necessarily do that. Each dot by itself has a finite compressibility. It still has a essentially unique ground state.
Maybe we should discuss that later. I think it's. I think in this model, especially in the case of Q is bigger than 4, then we'll have classically we'll have. I think. Are you talking about finite NFX or not? What I mean is in the Larsen limit. So maybe I'll be more, a little more precise. So that maybe this is. So the claim is that in the Larsen limit, right? We have a family of states that are characterized by. It's the thermofield double with this extra variable phi, and this is just given by starting with the thermofield double and then acting with e to the I a q1, right? So this is just classically, and then if you now take this mode and you really quantize this mode, right? Yeah. Then there will be energies that go like n squared over n, right? Over j, something like this.
There'll be some action phi dot squared.
Phi dot squared.
With a coefficient of order n.
What?
Oh, that there's a coefficient of order n of phi dot squared, and that's that you mean you're ignoring that.
Yes, yes.
Okay, all right. So that, okay, well, I see what you mean.
One over n. The energies go like one over n.
One over n.
Yeah, that's right. There's a term n over j phi dot squared, right?
Correct.
And so in the Larsen limit, we can ignore this because this is a very massive particle. And then for finite n, we indeed have a correction. So this will be like a superconductor in finite volume that has also a correction.
I see what you mean now.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I call the compressibility.
Though. Ah. Okay. Good. Good. Good.
Phi dot squared.
Sorry. Yeah. I thought that was the.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. In this case, you could say, well, when you are finite n, you really have a unique ground state, and all this business about the spontaneous symmetry breaking is not relevant. But for the case of energy, I think it is more relevant because the energy spaces are very, very tiny, and I think,
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? If not, then we should thank Juan again.
Okay. Thank you.